Chapter 10. Helga was, by habit, unfitted for conniving. Her scheme for how she would draw the secret out of her husband was simple and transparent, built around the fact that he was to sail next morning and this would be their last night together. What she meant to do, with no previous practice in such difficult magic, was to bring back their past, and that without ever having understood what it was. She still had the dress she had been wearing when he first saw her. While she was putting it on, before dinner, she imagined what would happen, or rather, what she would like to have happen, being unused to distinguishing the two. As she saw it, the conversation would not move gradually from step to step, as usually happens. In her thoughts, it galloped and leaped from peak to peak. "Do I remind you of someone?" she was going to ask. "Yes," he was going to reply as memories crept back upon him. "Freya." "And you believe in me still?" "Always. You are the most gently born of the gods, wearer of the flaming necklace, bringer of love, weeper of gold. How will you prove this to me?" "By giving you all that I most dearly prize, my love, my wealth, my secret." After that, there would be an embrace. At that point, she stopped thinking about it, because her desire was now for Theobrand. She would manage that detail in the easy, effective way known as somehow. The great thing was that the prize would be hers, to bring back to Theobrand in triumph. But good luck was not with her, because she had renounced him, and so did not suffer anything to turn out as she had planned. She waited vainly, all through dinner, for her husband to say something about the dress. He showed no sign of recognizing it, or even of noticing it. The fact is, he had decided to confide in her. He was silent and waiting, because Theobrand was at the table with them. Like his wife, he too had imagined how he would begin, but he meant to stick to truth and fact. "As a matter of justice to Eric," he was going to say, "I think his mother should be given the choice of coming with us." This would lead to all the rest, as it had led him to his decision to tell her. He knew that trusting to her silence would be a risk. As ship's master, he alone did not have the privilege of making a mistake, but after weighing his duty to ship against his duty to his son, he felt it was a risk that had to be taken. Reasonable safety could be had through an oath from her, threats from himself, and waiting until the night before they sailed, threats for want of one last effort to make her understand. Rather wish you had not tried than wish you had. When they went to their bedroom, he undressed at once, wanting rest for the next day's trying tasks. Helga opened one of the light holes in the wall and let the moon shine on her face. Just as he was about to begin speaking, she asked him whether she didn't remind him of someone. That distracted him, and he had to reassemble his thoughts. He did not answer, because he had not been paying attention to her, but only to what he meant to say to her. She repeated the question and pouted. "What did you say?" he asked, becoming conscious that she was speaking to him. He was annoyed by the interruption and became mindful that she still had time to spread the news, through folly or malice. She asked the question for the third time, now fairly shouting it. "I asked whether I don't remind you of someone." To that, he could not resist answering yes. She reminded him of her father, whom she was growing to look like more every day, and whom he disliked, probably for being her father. He made up his mind to wait with telling her until morning, the very last instant before they sailed. He was in bed by now. He turned over onto his side with his back towards her and shut his eyes. Things were turning out in grotesque opposition to the way Helga had daydreamed them. She became impatient, then irritable, then lost what self-possession she had and made the mistake of improvising. In a petulant tone, she accused him of never confiding in her anymore. He and his friends knew where that ship was really bound. Why didn't he tell her? Half asleep, he grunted, "The Orkneys." That brought a flood of tears and mild hysterics, through which she denounced him as a heathen, told him he was helping Satan, thwarting God, and other bits of Christian sermonizing whose source was unmistakable. That brought him sitting up, wide awake, and appreciating his narrow escape. She was encouraged by his attention, thinking it meant she was making headway at last, and went on exhorting. He began to be mirthful over her ill-fitting role of zealot, and when she told him earnestly that it was one of her holy duties to save his soul, he saw the whole thing very close to the way it had happened. At that, he let out such a roar of laughter and kept it up so long that she knew he was beyond her reach. With her looked-for triumph thus snatched from her, and any hope of praise or reward with it, she ran from the room holding her breath and gave full vent to hysterics outside. When she returned, somewhat later, tearful but no longer convulsed, he was asleep. She miserably followed him into bed and cried softly until she, too, fell asleep. When she awoke in the morning, he was gone. She learned from the servants that he was at the harbor with their son. Recollection of her failure made her weep again, and she went to Theobrand for sympathy. She told him what had happened, looking very appealing with her tear-stained, immature face. He realized that all she had accomplished was to make the holders of the secret more tight-lipped than ever. They would sail today with it still held from him. But he was not angry. His only feeling toward her was the sympathy she had come for. She had suffered the humiliation he had feared. The misgivings about her, which had flitted through his mind the day before, returned upon him in a great wave, filling him with reproach toward himself and tenderness toward her. He took her hands in his and called her his sister. Until now, neither of them had spoken of whether she should be baptized. Now, with neither of them yet speaking of it, because there was no need between two whose thoughts were so in accord, he dipped his fingers in holy water and spoke the Latin words that brought her into his faith. After it was done, they knelt together and prayed. He spoke the prayer, and she said it after him, repeating not only his words, but his intonation too, as if she were his voice's own reassuring echo. When they came to the end, he added a little silent prayer for himself, which differed from his prayer of the day before, in the more insistent way it forswore any desire for her. Besides guarding his soul, he wanted to assure himself, as a man, that he had not been so warped by his years as a hermit that he could be falling in love with an old woman of 26. Helga presently withdrew her hand from his and left him, because she had to go to the harbor and say goodbye to her husband. But in a few moments she was back, burning with a strange bit of news she had just gathered from the servants. It had been discovered that the image of Thor was not in the temple. Word of this had spread everywhere, causing many to believe that Thor had fled, unable to face the banishment that would be voted him at the Thing. In a way, that belief was correct, and she had no sooner babbled it excitedly to Theobrand than the servant who had told it to her came in with proof. Thor had been carried aboard the ship in the early hours of the morning and was now in the hold waiting for the tide, along with the plows, tableware, bedclothes, and the rest of the strange cargo. There was no doubt about it. Two men had seen it being done. Everyone was saying now that Thor had given up the fight and Olaf had already won. Helga praised the man for bringing the news, then sent him back to his labors so that she might receive from Theobrand the kiss of victory and exultation which she saw waiting on his lips. To Theobrand alone, of all who were not going on the ship, the embarkation of Thor revealed the truth about the expedition. He had studied the ways of idols in studying the people who worshipped them. He knew that a man expects his god to guard his home when he is away, and that when both of them go, leaving neither to guard, it is because they have a new home in mind. So went the Israelites towards Canaan, 40 years homeless, but carrying their ark all the while. So fled the survivors of Troy, escaping through the broken walls with their lairs and penates, with which they founded Rome. So came Ingulf to this very harbor with this selfsame idol, with which his great-grandson now. At last, the final bead of the rosary was in place, and Theobrand had his final fact, giving meaning to all the others. He knew the reasons for the secrecy, the lying, the cargo, the haste and the careless kindness to himself. But he knew it only at the last scanty instant, an hour before the tide would come to snatch the ship away. They had tricked him after all, keeping back the telltale action till the end. He and Helga exchanged the kiss in which they rejoiced together over Thor's surrender, so warmly that no account of praying would ever explain it away. But even while his arms were around her, his twofold mind was wondering whether there was not some way, some inspired, heaven-shown way, by which he could keep that defiant handful of heathen fish in Olaf's net and make God's victory complete.